Broadcasting live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue in beautiful downtown Milwaukee. It's time for The Upswing on WTMJ. Presented by Horicon Bank, the natural choice for all your banking needs. Showcasing businesses, entrepreneurs, and community leaders throughout the great state of Wisconsin. Here's Jeff Sherman.
Because I'm going to make this place yours.
Good morning, Wisconsin. Good morning, Milwaukee. Wow. What a weekend. Everywhere. Just crowded with tourists and locals, events and spending everywhere. Just sunshine and smiles across the entire area and across the entire state. Well, maybe a few bumps out at the ballpark, but that's okay. We still got 1 out of 3 at the weekend series. It was great to see Devin Williams back on the mound for sure. Speaking of the Brewers, Corey Hart was in town over the weekend for Ryan Braun's Brewers Walk of Fame induction ceremony on Sunday. He also had an event at Central Standard Distillery to showcase one of his new business ventures, Moonshine. So we're going to hear about that story later in the show. We'll get a full report on the state of housing in Wisconsin from the Wisconsin Policy Forum. And if you were driving around this weekend, as I was, did you notice gas prices? Do you? Like, do you check gas prices and do you go to one place over another to save a couple cents here or there? Or do you just always fill up when needed? Little background. In our house, we have one SUV and one EV. So I'm not always at the gas station on a regular basis, but I had the SUV out and about all over the area today or this weekend and really noticed we had, what, 389 out in Delafield. I saw 379 today in Shorewood. The national average for a gallon of gas is about 350 now. And it's hovered around that point for the last month or so. But there was a little uptick in the Midwest last week due to a reported storm-related outage at an ExxonMobil refinery in Illinois. And that was contributing to greater, higher pump prices in the upper Midwest, according to AAA. But meanwhile, oil prices have fallen a bit lately. In April, a barrel of oil was in the upper 80s, and today it's about $10 cheaper. So that might mitigate some upward price pressure at the pumps. But nationally, you compare gas prices to where they were a year ago, about a quarter less. But let's remember, it's an election year. So I wanted to dive into demand and prices and dynamics around gas. So joining us today is Abdur Chowdhury, a professor emeritus of economics at Marquette University. We are going to talk gas prices and data around policy. Professor, how are you this beautiful Monday?
Oh, I'm doing pretty well, and thank you for having me on your program.
Of course. Thanks for taking the time. So, do election politics dictate that we're going to hear more and more about gas prices in the coming months? I think I know the answer to this, but I wanted to have you on to dive into it a little deeper.
Yeah, we will hear about energy policy of the two major candidates, obviously, in the coming months. But in terms of affecting the price, I don't think there is too much effect. There are other factors that affect gas prices going up or going down, but we will be talking about energy policy a lot.
Yeah. So can gas prices sway elections? I saw over the weekend the gas price in Michigan hit a high of 381, and it's really become a political issue in Michigan for sure.
Unless the gas prices change by a very significant amount, I don't think it will have that much of an effect on election. But obviously, if you see a significant change, that will affect inflation, and people will talk about that because that will hit the pocketbooks.
All right. We are talking to Abdur Chowdhury, Professor Emeritus of Economics at Marquette University. This is The Upswing presented by Horicon Bank, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to The Upswing, presented by Horicon Bank. Out and about throughout the weekend, looking at gas prices. Do you go to this place? Do you go to that place? And does it affect where you choose to fill up your car? For me, it's all about convenience, I'm not going to lie, but you got to keep an eye on the price. So joining us this morning is Abdur Charhordi, Professor Emeritus of Economics at Marquette University. So, Professor, how can, especially through this election year, how do policymakers balance our desire, our consumer desire for stable gas prices with kind of the deeper environmental goals of reducing fossil fuel consumption?
Yes, that's a big issue, and I think it will be discussed a lot in the coming months. But basically, in order to balance, the environmental concerns, there are a couple of things that people can talk about and the government can think about. For example, cap and trade is something that we talk about. The government needs to establish some clean energy standards. They also have to minimize the financial risks of climate change. So there is, for example, tax credit for businesses that capture carbon emissions. Mm-hmm. So those are some of the things that the government can do to help the climate change issue and at the same time keep the gas prices relatively stable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so given, you know, there's significant price differences between states. What role do you think federal policy should play in addressing these regional disparities, or should it?
Actually, federal policy doesn't have much impact. The reason is this. If you look at gas price today in the U.S., the federal excise tax on gas is about 18 cents. And the reason why gas prices vary across states is because of environmental regulations are different, the proximity to refineries are different, transportation cost varies depending on how far away you are from the refinery. Just to give you some idea, California, for example, has imposed a 78 cents per gallon excise tax on gas per gallon. The second highest is in Illinois, 66 cents. In Wisconsin, it's 31 cents. So given this, you will always see some variation in prices across states.
Yeah. And when the state's petroleum cleanup program is added, total state taxes and fees collected at the pump in Wisconsin were about 33 cents. And that's, I think, the 11th highest in the nation. Yes. So what are your general thoughts on what a Harris presidency compared to a second term for Trump could mean to influence prices? Obviously, there's, you have the drill, baby, drill. You have the rhetoric on both sides. But from your lens, can that really have any impact on where prices go?
It will have some impact. It may not be too much, but there will be some impact. The main difference I see between a Harris presidency and a Trump, a second term, is their emphasis on reducing fossil fuel consumption. Harris wants to reduce the fossil fuel consumption, impose various type of environmental regulations, whereas Trump wants to do away with many of the regulations that we currently have. Now, the net impact of that will be, given everything else the same, I do see a slight higher gas price under a Harris administration than under a Trump administration. Because of their different regulations and because of the fossil fuel dependence policies.
Yeah. Are there measures that can be implemented to mitigate the impact of localized refinery outages like we saw last week that spiked the prices in the Midwest only?
With refineries, sometimes their maintenance and repair works are previously scheduled. So we know those when that will happen. On the other hand, what happened in Illinois with the ExxonMobil refinery recently, that was something that was not expected. It was due to a hurricane. So if we have something unexpected, it's very difficult for the government to step in so quickly to mitigate. But for instance, usually when they're regularly scheduled maintenance closure of refineries, the government can in different ways help to keep the supply going. For example, you know, making sure that refineries in other areas produce excess oil so that that can be brought into the affected areas.
Okay. Abdur Chaudhary, Professor Emeritus of Economics at Marquette University. I appreciate your time this morning and have a wonderful week.
Okay. Thank you very much for having me.
Yes. From the 262, just got to read this, coming in, I saw gas prices at about $3.50 yesterday at around I-43 and Highway 100 at a few stations. That's, you know, kind of similar to what I was seeing too, although I did say I saw $3.79 this morning as I was coming in from the North Shore. This is The Upswing. We're presented by Horicon Bank. When we come back, a little moonshine with the Milwaukee Brewers.
And he held out some moonshine whiskey a hole. He said it was the best in all the land. And I said, no, 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 I don't drink it no more. I'm tired of wicked.
Welcome back to The Upswing, presented by Horicon Bank. A beautiful Monday here in the heart of the state of Wisconsin, downtown Milwaukee. So former brewer Corey Hart has collaborated with Milwaukee's Central Standard Craft Distillery to create a new spirit called Corey Hart's Number One Ballpark Shine. Indeed, it's a smoked lemon-flavored moonshine that reflects his Kentucky roots. Corey, of course, played for our Milwaukee Brewers from 2004 to 2013, retiring as a brewer in 2017, after playing with the Seattle Mariners and the Pittsburgh Pirates. He was in town over the weekend. He talked to WTMJ's Sandy Max about his new business.
I was able to meet with Pat and Evan at one of our fantasy camps, and they, you know, they run Central Standard. So, you know, as a Kentucky guy, I don't shy away from whiskey. So we kind of got to hanging out and kind of became friends. And I kind of brought up that me and a friend of mine down here pretty regularly make moonshine, and we try to make like, you know, something fun, like a fun hobby. And, you know, we kind of created something we liked and we thought that they might like. So kind of one of those partnerships that, you know, I always do it anyway. So it's one of those trying to hang out with, it's a good way to connect with the city. You know, I was kind of hanging out with Evan and Pat anyway. So I kind of turned into a kind of a little fun friendship, and hopefully it helps them out and it gives me a reason to come back and drink, which is, you know, never a bad thing. So,
No, they know their craft beverages. You partnered with a really quality couple of guys, and obviously baseball fans as well. What is the flavor of Corey Hart's Number One Ballpark Shine?
It's kind of like a smoked lemon flavor, so hopefully it, you know, attracts people to drink it. But it's a little smoky. It's, you know, it's kind of like a pre-made drink, so it is moonshine, so it's kind of harsh, but you don't have to mix it. It's already set, so it's not super strong, but it has a kick to it. But it's something I drink all the time, so I can drink it whether with people or hanging out watching the game by myself. So it's kind of the right thing for me to drink.
How did you decide on the flavor with a citrus and a smoke?
So me and a friend of mine out here in Arizona, we were kind of doing it as a hobby anyway. Apple moonshine, apple pie is kind of where a lot of people start at just because you hear about it. So we kind of started doing that, and I was always drinking whiskey and lemonade. So we just kind of started messing with that, trying to make our variation. And the smoke flavor kind of, you know, we tried to smoke our whiskeys anyway. So it kind of just kind of naturally happened. And, again, smoke's not going to be for everyone, but it's something that I enjoy. And I think Pat and Evan down there kind of like the addition to it. So hopefully it sells. Hopefully it brings people to their place, and I enjoy drinking it when I can.
Former Milwaukee brewer Corey Hart diving into the entrepreneurial world with Milwaukee's Central Standard Craft Distillery, creating a new spirit called Corey Hart's Number One Ballpark Shine. He was in town this weekend for Ryan Braun's Wall of Fame induction ceremony and did an event at Central Standard. Always like to create a little buzz around entrepreneurship for Milwaukeeans, no matter who they are. So congrats to Corey Hart and Central Standard. So tomorrow on the show, Rich Kirchen from the Milwaukee Business Journal joins. Saw this over the weekend from the Business Journal. The Wahlburgers restaurant at the corners of Brookfield has closed after management at the complex negotiated an end to the restaurant lease as part of the strategy to develop a different tenant mix at the corners and a different range of services sought by customers. Now, I don't know, the business of burgers has always fascinated me, especially in Wisconsin where we are Culver's-centric, but there are so many amazing burgers on each and every corner. But we haven't really embraced the big national celebrity burger. The Wahlburgers closed in the Third Ward. The Wahlburgers now closing in Brookfield. They're still, I believe, let's get this right, Wahlburgers maintains six other locations around the state of Wisconsin in Ashwaubenon, Eau Claire, Fitchburg, Janesville, La Crosse, and Madison. But I don't know. What do we think about the future of the Big Burger franchise in Wisconsin? I think we're going to stay true to our Culver's and to our corner bars and to the places that we know and love. That's what we are as Wisconsinites. But it's always really interesting to see the big guys, the national chains. In this case, Wahlburgers is owned by Hy-Vee, comes in, franchises, kind of tries to take over a portion of the market. And I don't know. We're just not quite there yet. One franchise that has done it well, I think, in the greater Milwaukee area, from a burger standpoint, come into Wisconsin and done really well, is Shake Shack in the Third Ward and also out in Brookfield. I don't know. Give us your thoughts on the WTMJ Talk and Text Line, 855-616-1620. We are The Upswing. We're presented by Horicon Bank. Welcome back to The Upswing, presented by Horicon Bank. Lots of text coming in regarding our burger conversation, Wahlburgers closing out at the corners in Brookfield. Obviously, we're full of so many amazing burgers. I need to do a full show on the business of burgers, so we're going to line that up. But you got cops, people calling in about Oscars from the 414. Fatty Patty is a food truck and brick-and-mortar restaurant. Everyone says it's so delicious, and their fries are fabulous. Lots of passion around burgers, for sure. All right, so the Wisconsin Policy Forum is out with a new report on housing, and on Friday held a virtual event focused on Wisconsin's growing challenges in building and creating an adequate range of affordable housing options across the state. Housing, obviously, has become increasingly more challenging to build and more unaffordable, not only in Wisconsin, but nationally. Since 2021, Wisconsin has issued more permits for housing construction, but the pace has declined slightly over the last 2 years and still lags far behind the housing boom of the early 2000s. Mark Sommerhauser is the communications director and policy researcher for the Wisconsin Policy Forum. He joins us this morning on the Tri-County Contracting Hotline. Mark, thanks for taking time this morning.
Absolutely. Jeff, thank you for having me.
Of course. So let's go right into kind of the marriage, if you will, between housing and population. Do they truly go together? For example, the Milwaukee mayor wants to grow the population to 1 million. Without new housing, this is just seemingly impossible. Not to mention, there's a lot of other variables at play. But is it simply easy to say that housing and population are always married?
Well, I think there's no question, that they're closely linked together. The mayor's target, obviously, is just for the city of Milwaukee. In our report, we looked at metro areas throughout the state. So, for instance, we looked at metro Milwaukee, which includes Milwaukee County as well as the three WOW counties. Mm-hmm. And, we did see an overall decline in the pace of new housing construction permitting here over the last 3 years, for which we have data, 21, 22, and 23. relative to those years leading up to the pandemic. So, you know, that tells us that really the overall pace of permitting is not increasing here in Metro Milwaukee, and if anything, has gone down.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, we're here in Milwaukee, the state's largest housing market, and that decline lost the last 3 years in multifamily construction. What are the factors contributing to the decline in single-family housing permits in not only Milwaukee, but also in Madison? And Madison is still, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it's still the hottest housing market in the state, correct?
That's correct. And yeah, and I'm actually, most of my former colleagues are based in Milwaukee, but I actually work out of the Madison area. And so actually when we were crunching those numbers, I was personally quite surprised to see that come back the way it did, because Metro Madison continues to be really a very hot housing market, still seeing a lot of population growth, and yet actually building fewer single family homes or permitting fewer single family homes. So there's no question that there's a lot that goes into that. One thing that we heard from a few of the experts that we consulted, and which we detail a little bit in our report, we don't go deeply into it, but we did kind of just wade into these numbers, is the issues around creating new subdivisions and new lots. Obviously, you know, a buildable lot for a single family home is just the first step in the process. And we have seen a pretty significant decline actually statewide over time in the number of newly created lots that are being recorded, both with the state and with the county register of deeds in which they're being created. And I, you know, we were particularly surprised to see that here in the Metro Madison area, again, even with population growth, very large increases in single family home prices, we have actually seen fewer new lots created over the last 3 years for which we have data. Again, that was 2021, 22, and 23 relative to those years immediately before the pandemic. So that's comparing that to 2017, 18, and 19. We've seen a decrease in new lot construction. That was surprising to us.
Yeah, I want to dive into what accounts for that difference when we come back from the break. We're talking with Mark Sommerhauser from the Wisconsin Policy Forum, a new report regarding housing permitting in the state of Wisconsin. This is The Upswing, and we're presented by Horicon Bank.
Our house.
Welcome back to The Upswing. Mark Sommerhauser is the Communications Director and Policy Researcher for the Wisconsin Policy Forum. He joins us this morning on the Tri-County Contracting Hotline. Housing permitting is slowed, adding to affordability concerns across the state of Wisconsin. So, Mark, how does Wisconsin's housing permitting per capita compare to national averages? And what do you think can be driving some of that difference?
Yeah, so just taking the most recent year of data that we looked at here, 2023, we did it as you said, as a per capita rate, so housing units permitted per 1,000 residents. Last year, Wisconsin permitted about about 3.47 housing units per 1,000 residents. That's compared to nationally, that rate is about 4.5. So we are somewhat below the national rate. I think that's not totally surprising given our demographics here in Wisconsin. We're not growing quite as rapidly as some of their states. So, you know, you might expect it, certainly, obviously, if you're comparing, for instance, to the Sun Belt states and these places where, you know, there's just a lot more robust population growth. But nonetheless, we are behind that national rate.
Yeah. And as you talked about before the break, I mean, the impact of long-term decline in new lot creation has really had a sense of availability of affordable housing across the state, right?
Yeah, I think that's definitely one factor. And, you know, we went through this period, obviously, where we saw a tremendous amount of new housing being built in the early to mid 2000s. That's, you know, still sort of the high watermark for virtually all the data sets that we have, certainly going back through the 21st century and even before that. Then we all know kind of what happened after that. We saw the crash in the Great Recession. Then we had a period in the 20-teens where housing construction increased slightly after the coming out of the Great Recession, but really stayed at quite a low level by historical standards throughout most of the 20-teens. And I think we're starting to see the cumulative effect of that in terms of the constraints on housing inventory. The issue around new lot creation is really kind of a puzzle. You know, certainly one thing that we are hearing from a couple of folks that we spoke to is that a lot of people are struggling to get financing, you know, to be able to plat new subdivisions and create new lots. So, you know, that certainly could be one factor at play.
Yeah. From the 262, and we can talk about this for sure, a 1,200 square foot starter homes are non-existent because zoning has outlawed them. They only want mid-range to high-end homes. So I got to ask, you know, what strategies are local governments and policymakers in Wisconsin considering to address affordability concerns?
Yeah, that's a great question. So our report, you know, the forum only looks at state and local public policy. We don't deal with anything at the federal level. Obviously, you know, things like mortgage interest rates are something that state and local policymakers can't do much
right.
to affect. But there are levers that state and local policymakers can pull. I do want to say, to the credit of our legislature and our governor, they did work together in a bipartisan fashion here in the most recent state budget in 2023 to pass a package of bills that passed through the Republican legislature. Our Democrat governor did sign them that are going to try to make some more resources available to local governments and through the state to help finance the construction of, you know, more affordable housing. So that is one step that's already been taken. At the local level, though, there definitely are some tools that some municipalities are starting to use. Others are kind of having that debate because it can be very contentious, as you know.
Yes.
But, you know, there are measures that can be taken to around land use and around permitting to, number one, you know, just make it easier for developers and builders to obtain permits, you know, easier. When I say easier, I mean quicker, but also more predictable in terms of the process and in some cases, less expensive. And then, you know, some of the most contentious debates are always around zoning and land use. And, you know, I'm sure you've seen that in a lot of communities in Metro Milwaukee. We see that here in Metro Madison. But, you know, there is a lot of discussion about, you know, permitting more types of housing to be built in various neighborhoods, often single family zone neighborhoods that, you know, can provide a lot more housing that's going to be available at a more affordable price point.
Yeah. When we come back, which Wisconsin community is doing this right and why? Mark Sommerhauser from the Wisconsin Policy Forum joins us. This is The Upswing. We're presented by Horicon Bank.
Our house is a very, very, very fine house with two cats in the yard. Life used to
Welcome back
so
to The Upswing, presented by Horicon Bank. Joining us on the Tri-County Contracting Hotline is Mark Sommerhauser from the Wisconsin Policy Forum. Conclusion of a new study just released. For prospective home buyers, the state's sluggish pace of single-family home permitting suggests that, absent major changes in the housing market, there may be little relief in store for rising prices. Obviously, having a higher pace of multifamily housing construction is welcome news for renters, but it's still going to be insufficient to meet the demand created by population and household growth in some communities. So, Mark, as you look market to market and maybe even compare and contrast a little bit Milwaukee and Madison, but which Wisconsin communities are kind of doing the right things to spur additional housing development?
Sure, yeah. And I should say, you know, we're just kind of looking at the data here and trying to follow where that leads us.
Mm-hmm.
I think looking at Milwaukee and Madison, you know, in Milwaukee, we're seeing over the last few years here essentially a stagnant pace of single-family permitting, a decrease in multifamily permitting. So I think certainly that, you know, that is somewhat concerning to us. We know that Metro Milwaukee is not really growing in population, so that's obviously one factor. But, you know, despite the population staying roughly flat, the number of households in Metro Milwaukee has increased just in the last about 6 years. We saw about a 5% increase in the total number of households. So we know that households are kind of the unit at which housing is obtained, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so if your population, even if your total population is not increasing, if you're seeing more households, you're going to need more housing. And I think, You know, another factor to keep in mind in Metro Milwaukee is the age of the housing stock. Milwaukee has a lot of older housing. And so that means that there is, you know, some housing that is kind of nearing the end of its useful life. And that's another factor that can, you know, put pressure on the need for new housing. Metro Madison, it's been a very, we have seen an increase here in Metro Madison in the levels of housing permitting, but you really have to zoom in and distinguish between multifamily and single family, because that there's a big difference. And we've seen a large increase in multifamily permitting here in Madison. That's welcome news. That's great news for renters here in Metro Madison. I think there's no question it was needed. But not seeing the corresponding increase on the single family side. And that's obviously concerning for anybody who's, you know, in the market for a single family home here in this area. Looking around the rest of the state, one of the metros that does stand out here, I think, is Eau Claire.
Okay.
Has seen quite a significant increase, actually, in new housing permitting. So that's, you know, really notable. It has, once again, been really heavily skewed toward the multifamily permitting. So, again, I think very good news for renters in that market, but not really an increase in single family permitting. One of the few metros that I could find that has actually seen an increase in both multifamily and single family was the Appleton MSA. So that, I think, is good news for both renters and home buyers in that metro area. There has been an increase on both sides of the ledger there.
Did Eau Claire and Appleton, were there specific policy or zoning changes that had a factor in those increases?
That's a good question. We weren't able to look and kind of drill down to that level of detail. We looked at 10 different metro areas as part of our analysis. I think it would be a really interesting follow-up, you know, to go back and look and see, were there actual policy changes within each of these 10 metro areas that might have been a factor.
All right. Very good. Well, it's definitely something to keep on the radar, especially throughout the election year, recent trends in housing construction and permitting and how they'll impact the long-term economic and social landscape across the state of Wisconsin. Mark Sommerhauser from the Wisconsin Policy Forum, appreciate you spending time with us on The Upswing today.
You bet, Jeff.
All right.